Hello, it's John Dennis on Friday the 20th of February. Today, a major review of primary school education says teachers should have more power to decide what they teach.
There are questions clearly about standards. Each year we have the SAT results published and there is a shortfall in respect to the current target.
And UK PLC faces debts of up to £1.5 trillion.
It is absolutely huge. You say, what's a £500 billion between friends? Actually, it's a vast amount of money. They said it's something between £1 trillion and £1.5 trillion.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But before we hear about any of that, let's hear today's news headlines and have a look at the papers with Sandy Waugh.
The billionaire tycoon Alan Stanford has been found by the FBI and served with civil papers following allegations of an $8 billion fraud. Agents tracked Stanford to a car in Fredericksburg in the US state of Virginia. At present, he's not under arrest and does not face criminal charges, but he faces the financial meltdown of his Stanford Investment Bank, including the freezing of his assets said to be worth $8 billion. Meanwhile, regulators in Antigua and in the United States have come under fire for not moving quickly enough to stop the alleged fraud. Primary schools in England focus too closely on literacy and numeracy at the expense of more creative teaching, according to a new study. The review carried out by Cambridge University is the biggest of its kind in 40 years. It says schools should be freed from league tables and national tests to allow them to make more decisions about what they teach. It also accuses the government of micromanaging schools. The Department for Children, Schools and Families says it will consider the report. A murder hunt's underway in London after a teenager was found stabbed to death. The 19-year-old received fatal knife wounds at a service station in Wilston in northwest London last night. Another 19-year-old man also suffered stab wounds and is said to be in a stable condition. Benjamin Netanyahu looks set to become Israel's next prime minister at the head of a right-wing coalition after he won the endorsement of a far-right politician. Tzipi Livni said her Kadima party would go into opposition, even though it won the most seats in the election. Netanyahu opposes the return to peace talks with the Palestinians and has pledged to continue settlement expansion. He also argues for the toppling of Hamas in Gaza. In cricket, the third test in Antigua resulted in a draw as England failed to take the final West Indian wicket in a dramatic climax. Captain Andrew Strauss said that to come so close and not win felt almost like a defeat. The team move on to Barbados for the fourth test next week, with England still trailing 1-0 in the series. Now for a look at today's papers, starting with the Mail, which has the figure £2 trillion printed in red numerals across its front page. That's the current state of the national debt and is equivalent to £33,000 each, says the paper. Doubt's been cast over the conviction of Eddie Kilfoyle for the murder of his wife in 1992, says the Times. Notes have been found that catalogue a series of police blunders in the investigation. The Sun leads with a grainy map of the ocean floor off the coast of Africa. It claims the faint outline of a grid could be the lost city of Atlantis. The Mirror is one of the papers that reports a breakthrough in the search for a drug to remedy peanut allergies. The finding gives hope to the estimated 440,000 people who suffer from the condition. The Telegraph reports that primary school children in Yorkshire are being asked to think like suicide bombers in a role-playing exercise designed to combat violent extremism. The paper's leader column calls the plans ridiculous and dangerous. In The Independent, there's news that Ryanair is allowing passengers to use mobile phones while in flight. However, only one UK mobile network has signed up to the scheme so far. Iran has enough uranium for a nuclear bomb, according to the FT. And finally, in The Express, there are fears the price of tea is set to soar because of the falling value of sterling. The average brew made in the home could soon rise to as much as 3 pence per cup, it says. More news and sport through the day at guardian.co.uk.
Our children's lives are poorer because of a fundamentally deficient education system. There's too much emphasis on basic literacy and numeracy at the expense of other subjects such as history, geography, the arts, and even science. That's according to the biggest inquiry into primary education for 40 years. Professor Robin Alexander led the Cambridge University-based Primary Review. He spoke to our education editor, Polly Curtis.
We're arguing for an aims-driven curriculum. We're arguing for a concept of entitlement which treats entitlement qualitatively rather than quantitatively. In other words, it's not just about the number of subjects, but it's about a high quality of teaching and learning in all of those, regardless of how much time. We're arguing for, as I said, the reintegration of the literacy and numeracy components of the strategies to the rest of the curriculum.
And that means instead of teaching literacy and numeracy as distinct hours?
No, it doesn't mean that. It's even possible that they might continue that way. It's about conceptualization. It's about not so much mathematics. There's a pretty widespread support for the numeracy strategy or the numeracy component of the primary strategy. Much less support, except perhaps mostly from younger teachers, for the literacy element. And that seems, according to the evidence from pretty august organisations which we've received, to have actually fundamentally disturbed this whole area of the teaching of English. And we argue for reconceptualisation, we call it language, oracy and literacy, because we believe that oracy is actually pretty important too, very important. So it's not so much about, it's certainly not about timetabling, it's not about whether one does something in a specialised or non-specialised way. That's a long way down the line, that's for teachers and others to decide. All we've offered is a framework here, all we've come up with is a framework here, and an invitation to those who are concerned about these things to reconsider the conceptual framework of the curriculum. And our conceptual framework has aims, it has domains, it has a national component and a local component. It's quite simple.
When you talk about the narrowing of the curriculum, part of the reason why it's narrowed is because of the focus on testing and league tables. What will you say about that?
What we say in this report is what needs to be said about testing, which is that in submission after submission, we had concern expressed to us that the current testing arrangements were compromising the rest of the curriculum, and compromising what, it must be remembered, is a statutory entitlement to a broad and balanced curriculum. If that is so, then the testing arrangements need to change. It should be possible to assess children's learning and for schools to be thoroughly accountable to parents and to government, to anyone else, with a procedure which does not compromise the very thing which schools are existing are supposed to be undertaking.
Robin Alexander talking to Polly Curtis, and there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/education. Also on The Guardian's website today, Thomas Keneally, author of Schindler's Ark, later Schindler's List of course, describes the aftermath of the Australian bushfires at guardian.co.uk/G2. Patrick Barkham meets the Woolworths staff who are preparing to open their own shop, Wellworths, in the former Woolworths building in Dorset, guardian.co.uk/business. And John Hooper profiles the former Italian Prime Minister Giulio Andreotti ahead of the release of the film about his alleged ties to the mafia, Il Divo, at guardian.co.uk/film. The cricket tycoon Sir Alan Stanford is accused in America of an $8 billion fraud, and the extent of the scandal isn't known. But the Caribbean island of Antigua, with a population of 70,000, risks being the worst hit. The Guardian's Ed Pilkington is in the capital, St John's.
He owns a house on this island. He also owns a larger house on a nearby smaller island, and he stays on his yacht a lot, a super yacht that he keeps in the bay here. But up at his house, which is sort of just north of the capital, St John's, it's a fairly modest little building. I was quite struck by how small it was, but it's totally shuttered up. The blinds are all drawn. A security guard at the gate, who's, has to be said, not very friendly, says no one is there. And then when I spoke to a neighbour across the road, they said they hadn't seen him for over a year. And when he did turn up, it was very fleetingly. So I think his presence in Antigua itself is not huge. Personally, he obviously does a huge amount of business here and he owns a large part of the island, but it's not as though he hangs out here personally. I think he tends to hang out more in the US Virgin Islands and on his yacht.
Can you describe for us the relationship between Alan Stanford and Antigua?
Well, the word fiefdom, I think, is appropriate in this case. He had a very, very close relationship with a lot of top politicians here, and he was the main private employer. He is the main private employer. Let's not talk about him in the past tense. He's still very prevalent in this island. It's a tiny little island. He owns many of the big sort of money-making ventures he's built. As you land in the airport, it's sort of put straight in front of your face. Everything you see around you as you come out of a tiny little Caribbean airport is owned by him. He straight ahead is this huge big mansion house, which is his private bank, where people have been coming over the last few days trying to withdraw all their fortunes. To the left of it is the main commercial Bank of Antigua, which he also pretty much owns. And yesterday there was a huge line of people that snaked all the way around the building trying to withdraw their money from that. To the left of that is the cricket ground where he held the very controversial 2020 last November, the cricket match between his so-called Stanford superstars and the English cricket team. A couple of restaurants too in that sort of compound. So it's the whole of the sort of airport area is like a sort of memorial to him. It's very garish and kind of rather shocking.
And he also wields considerable political power in Antigua.
Yes, there's been substantial and consistent allegations that he was involved in sort of soft forms of bribery and corruption with the previous government, Labour government of Lester Byrd. He was involved in various scandals concerning land swap deals in which he was said to have bribed a couple of their main assembly people. The current government, the UPP, has also had good relationships with him, although there haven't been any sort of bribery scandals since they took power. But there's a current election coming up in which Lester Byrd, his previous very close colleague, is standing for election again. So the whole subject is back in the air here in Antigua.
And what are the implications of this scandal for the people of Antigua?
Well, he's the main private employer on the island. Figures are slightly difficult to ascertain, but people think he probably employs about 5% or 1 in 20 of the workforce here. There have been already about 200 people laid off, and a lot of fear around that many more will now be laid off because whatever happens to him and the SEC inquiry into him in America, it's clear that he's in a lot of financial trouble. So there's fears for people associated with the cricket industry, with the entertainments business, the restaurants he owns, and obviously the banking sector. And that spreads pretty wide across such a tiny island. So there's a lot of apprehension here in Antigua today.
I'm John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, Monty Don tells us why he's backing a new national trust scheme to promote allotments.
I think most people are unaware of how tenuous our food supply is. And the whole thing could come tumbling down in exactly the same way as the banks have.
But first, the government's rescue of some of Britain's biggest banks will push up the national debt by as much as £1.5 trillion. That's what the Office for National Statistics has said. Our economics correspondent, Ashley Seeger, has the details.
They've said basically one thing we already knew and one thing we didn't. One, that they were going to have to classify Royal Bank of Scotland as a public corporation, given that the taxpayer now owns 70% of it. That we knew. What we didn't know was that they were going to classify Lloyds Banking Group, which now owns, of course, Halifax. Although the public sector only owns 43%, they've decided that, to all intents and purposes, it's controlled by the state, therefore is considered part of the public sector. What that means is they've added all the liabilities on of both banking groups to the national debt, or said they will add them on because they still haven't calculated how much they are. But unfortunately, because of international statistical rules, they can only count a few of the assets of the bank. So you get a slightly distorted picture, but it will have the effect of swelling the national debt by up to £1.5 trillion.
You said that they're still trying to calculate the amount of this liability. When will we know the scale of it? Because you say it's up to £1.5 trillion, but the area of estimate is pretty massive, isn't it?
It is absolutely huge. You say, what's £0.5 trillion between friends? Actually, it's a vast amount of money. They said it's something between £1 trillion and £1.5 trillion. The reason for the uncertainty is these are very big, very complex banking institutions. If you look at RBS, it owns ABN AMRO. You have to net out the any foreign liabilities and assets and just deal with the UK side of it. RBS also owns various parts of the country's trains. It owns lots of insurance companies. It owns NatWest. You know, it's a complex thing to pull apart. Likewise with Lloyds and HBOS. And so they've said it's just going to take them a long time to go through the numbers and decide exactly what the liabilities are.
And does it matter that the public debt is on this massive scale?
It does and it doesn't, I think is fair to say. I know that's a typical economist's answer, if you like, but I mean, it's always scary when the public debt goes from, you know, 5 years ago it was 30% of GDP, now it's 50%, it could go to 150%. Does it matter? Japan's at 180%, plenty of countries are over 100% already. So it does matter that it's growing, I think. Having said that, it doesn't, or it may not matter, because at some point those banks will be returned to the private sector. Those liabilities will disappear off the public books, we hope, at some point. And therefore, suddenly the national debt will drop massively. Yes, it matters because you're always worried when debts go up. But no, it hopefully doesn't matter because they will disappear at some point.
Now, Alistair Darling's budget is scheduled for April. Do you think we could expect a further large-scale stimulus in a couple of months' time?
I think we need a stimulus. I think this economy is bust and is still going down at a rapid rate, and interest rates have been finally cut very low, but they were cut slowly. The bank has been very slow, the Bank of England, to embark on this thing called quantitative easing, which we lazily call printing money. So I think this economy needs all the help it can get. So I think we do need a fiscal stimulus. Will we get one? Probably, but probably not of the amounts we probably need.
Ashley Seeger. Now, another thought for the day, the latest and the last in the Guardian's Comment is Free series of atheist monologues. Today, Polly Toynbee, you couldn't have a series like this without Polly, on the recession.
As recession darkens and threatens to become depression, difficult questions, suppressed in the good years, are thrown into sharp relief. Who's to blame? Grossly overpaid bankers are very satisfying enemies. But a more ominous target is emerging. Foreigners. Foreign workers taking British jobs. The sight of strikers waving placards bearing Gordon Brown's ill-chosen populist words stirs great fears. Memories of the rise of Hitler, blaming Jews for the hardship of others in a deep depression. Could we be seeing the first dismal stirrings here and now? The protests have shifted from Lincolnshire to the Isle of Grain, where local workers are protesting at a building contract given to a Polish firm importing Polish workers. Trade unions are receiving complaints of many similar deals, excluding local British workers. With unemployment at almost 2 million, it's not surprising. In the good years, opening Europe was a great leap forward. It underpinned some of the wealth created. The government claimed it brought in an extra £2 million a year. In the days of little unemployment, it was a dormant, though never quite dead, issue. Now it's in danger of erupting. What are we to think? Those of us who welcomed the great opening up of Europe, preventing those old tribal European world wars that tore apart the last century, need to think honestly about this. It's not enough to dismiss these protests as anti-European, xenophobic scapegoating. For the fact is, the effect of migrant workers falls on the lower paid. Be blunt, there are no contractors bringing Lithuanians or Estonians crowding into The Guardian to displace British journalists from our jobs, nor are they bustling into other professions. It's easy to be magnanimous with other people's jobs. At the root of the problem is the same old British disease. In the good times, the great gains were shared more unequally here. The lower paid falling out of work, suffering far more. In bad times, redistributing wealth is even more important. But you hear very few politicians willing to say so. Unless we can find the spirit of sharing, then we can expect outbursts against those who may be the wrong targets. We need to do far more to protect the most vulnerable by creating jobs, building up infrastructure, even if it means taxing those who are not suffering significantly more. For those in secure work, these are good times with low prices, near zero inflation, and they can afford to share with those falling out of work, or else face growing social unrest, often directed at foreigners, when it should be directed at those doing well but not sharing the proceeds.
Polly Toynbee, and you can listen to the whole series of Another Thoughts for the Day, which has come to us through the good offices of the Humanist Society of Scotland at guardian.co.uk/comment is free.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
1,000 allotments are to be created on National Trust land. The Trust hopes to connect its available plots with would-be vegetable growers via its Landshare website. And the scheme supported by Monty Don, president of the Soil Association. He told The Guardian's consumer affairs editor, Rebecca Smithers, why allotments are so important.
I think the scheme
is exciting not just because it's more allotments and we can never have too many. And also, by the way, it's worth pointing out that allotments have decreased steadily since the Second World War. So there's a lot of ground to make up. It exactly catches the zeitgeist of what we have to be doing, because I think most people are unaware of how tenuous our food supply is. And the whole thing could come tumbling down in exactly the same way as the banks have. It depends upon global supply, it depends upon cheap oil, it depends upon cheap fertilizer, it depends upon eating meat that demands huge amounts of land, oil, and water. I mean, that's something that is always underestimated, the enormous amount of water needed for cheap meat. And I genuinely believe that the whole thing is going to come crashing down. So we have to grow more of our own food, or we won't survive. And it's really literal, it's serious. And the way to start must be at home. And the beauty of that is it's not about the tyranny of having to dig the ground and grow things. It's the liberation from the tyranny of supermarkets and the tyranny of this anonymous food supply. And you get back to basics. And it goes back to a very British tradition of diggers and levellers and common ground and proudly being independent and keeping a cow and maybe some chickens and growing some food and a pig. And these were things that people did right up to the Second World War, actually, in urban situations that would be surprising to people now. And I think we can tap back into it. And I think that allotments, which have become an urban phenomenon, make available the opportunity to grow some food to people who feel somehow they're out of that loop. You know, that's part of the dignity of being human, actually, without being too pompous about it. It's really as central as that. And we've become this sort of craven society, given trash to eat, pushed around. I just think we should say enough, no more. You know, all of us deserve good food. All of us deserve to be treated with respect. And you can start that process. You can control it. And, you know, I really believe that is where allotments come from.
And have you always grown your own vegetables?
Since I was a small boy, yeah. And in fact, it really came when I was about 17. I was living at home, and I was one of five children, but I was the only one at home that time. I was the youngest. My parents were ill, and I took over the vegetable garden. So since I was 17, I've always had a vegetable garden. And in fact, when I was at college, I used to grow vegetables in a couple of gardens for them, and then I'd keep them for myself. When I had to come and live in London for 10 years, I chose where I wanted to live entirely by the size of the garden. And I moved out because I wanted a bigger garden. So yeah, I mean, but that's my passion. I suspect that most people are slightly less fanatical about it than I am. But that doesn't mean to say that everybody can grow something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the
Even
point.
Even a few herbs in a window box.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's not a sort of like growing a houseplant. It actually connects you to food, and food is the centre of life.
Monty Don talking to Rebecca Smithers. Andy Duckworth and Phil Maynard produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.